Chapter 27. A broken skull cracked and clattered as it fell to the stone floor of the crypt. Tyrone didn't look up from a small bronze plaque on the wall above a dusty alcove.
"Go away,"
he said to whatever intruder had disturbed the ancient bones.
Right, well, I would, sir, but some of the lads were asking after you,"
Ned offered. The ghoul shuffled farther into the crypt, wearing a toadying smile that looked more desperate than ingratiating. Tyrone said nothing. According to the thin and tarnished engraving, the young woman whose grave preoccupied him had died during the Sixth Age. The exact date was impossible to read, as time had corroded away the year. Her mortal remains had long decayed. There was nothing left of her but dust and chunks of brittle bone. Yet most of her sad epitaph was still legible, noting that she had died at 16 years of age. Tyrone recalled that little Aubie would be almost 16 by now, assuming she was still alive.
"You see, sir, it's just that you were going to personally lead the sacking of East Upshore, and while I don't want to suggest that it isn't going well—"
He was interrupted by the cry of a bannerman outside being violently conscripted into the undead army.
"Because it's going very well," Ned continued. "But we couldn't help notice that you've, recused yourself from the battle. And, you know, Ted and I respect that there are many styles of leadership, and we didn't expect you on the front lines. But it was suggested that you might want some say as to, what we're doing out here."
"And what are we doing out here?"
Tyrone asked, touching the plaque with a skeletal finger. The young woman's name had faded away, lost to the ages.
"Well, I figured you'd come looking for a snack, which didn't seem too bad an idea to me, of course."
The ghoul shrugged his shoulders.
"But anyone worth eating has already clawed their way to the surface and joined the ranks. Nothing down here but broken bones and grave dust."
Tyrone had stopped listening.
"What did she dream of?"
he wondered aloud.
"Did she want to take up a trade? To travel the world? Would she have had children of her own? What did her death deny her?"
The ghoul's jaw flapped open and shut like a fish gasping for breath.
I suppose I couldn't say, sir."
"There's a first time for everything," murmured Tyrone.
Ned's face lit up as he made a sudden connection.
"Ah, but sir, that's why we're marching on Enderin, isn't it? All these poor sods died, and that was it. No more hopes and dreams for them. But we came back after we died. It isn't the end for us."
"Oh?" asked Tyrone. "And what hopes and dreams are you currently pursuing, Ned?"
"Well, I—"
Ned stopped and thought for a moment.
"I suppose there's always immortality. Continued existence is always a fundamental drive of any biological organism. Not that we're strictly biological these days, of course, but beyond that, I've...
The ghoul trailed off with his fangs set in a troubled grimace.
"Is this what you always dreamed of?"
Tyrone's voice was bitter and hollow, even for a walking skeleton.
"Did you always want to raise Perrald or march on the Freedlands?"
"Not specifically."
Nedard Biggins always ceded as little ground as possible in any debate. Tyrone's hand curled into a bony fist.
"We can do nothing that isn't the Master's will, and all the Lich wills us to do is shackle other people with the same curse that we bear."
Whoa, easy there, sir,"
said the ghoul, waving his hands in the air. "These are dangerous thoughts." The knight commander shook his head and stared at the plaque. So young. For a creature who allegedly spent his existence skulking about crypts, Ned couldn't endure silence very long.
"Besides, sir, there are worse fights than undeath. Remember? You said yourself it isn't so bad."
Tyrone whirled on the ghoul, arcs of crimson energy crackling across his hands. The plaques on the walls darkened, and shadows like black flames licked stones by his feet.
"It isn't so bad for me," he snarled. "It isn't so bad for a drunken, washed-up soldier who threw everything away. But not for her. It's not enough for her."
Ned's face screwed up in confusion.
"But you aren't... I mean, sir, you're a noble hero. You were with us at the walls of Vetchel."
"Not on purpose," said Tyrone. "I was drunk. I lost my way and wound up dying. This wasn't my fight then, and it's not my fight today."
I don't know what to make of that."
Ned's voice was more of a whisper to himself.
But still, given that—
I do not care, said Tyrone, straightening himself. I want no part of it. Leave me.
But, sir, I said leave me.
Tyrone said it with more force than he intended, but the message was received better than expected. The ghoul went rigid, as though affected by the sudden onset of rigor mortis. Without another word, Ned turned and goose-stepped out of the crypt. Tyrone turned back to the grave. A miasma of dark magic emanating from him was corroding away the plaque on the wall, and jagged scorch marks had crept up the stones of the mausoleum and over the grave dust. For a time, he stared at the remains, haunted by his own memories. He saw the many men and women he'd sent to their deaths at the recruitment tables. He saw himself drinking alone in his offices, blithely ignoring the soldiers asking him for help. He saw the fights with his wife, scaring the little girl hiding in the corner. And he saw little Aubie playing on his knee, her tawny curls bouncing around her smile. An ache roiled in the dark cavern where his heart used to be. Tyrone's mood was as foul as the sludge dripping from his armor by the time another figure cast a shadow through the door of the mausoleum. Leave me, he said.
I think not, said Datara Ermion. You and I will have a word.
A piercing chill ran through Tyrone, cutting through even the veil of undeath. He remained defiantly silent as the lich floated into the chamber.
I must admit I'm surprised that you would be one for treason, mused Datar. I mean, I've learned that you can't trust anyone with all of your secrets, and I certainly suspected Lady Caribay would eventually try to overthrow me. She's a vampire, after all, and the gods know how much they love their schemes and intrigue. But you, the lich shook his head as he paced in a wide circle around Tyrone, you've been instrumental in shaping the movement. You're a founding figure of the revolution, our revolution. You've been given boundless authority, limitless opportunity. No master of undeath before me has offered any of his subjects such freedom. And you repay me with this defiance?
In truth, keeping his silence was about as much defiance as Tyrone could muster. The same foul sorceries that bound his soul to his remains shackled him in Datar's service, and a part of him wanted to bow his head in deference and get back to work.
I suppose that I should have learned by now to expect this sort of disappointment.
The lich paced around the Knight Commander. I had so much planned for you.
For us.
More power and
subjects, growled Tyrone. Oh, you have no idea what sorts of power I'm dealing with, said Datar.
Nor do you need to. It is enough for you to know that you are making a better world. A world without pain, without struggle. Without ending,
without movement, without achievement, without joy.
The words were coming easier to Tyrone now, his will gaining strength as he exercised it.
You may take away life's hardships, but you also take away everything that makes it worth living.
It's worth it, said Datar.
Maybe for you or I, said Tyrone, but is it really what you'd want for your children?
Obedience, conformity, an unshakable constitution? Said Datar.
Gods, you don't know how many times I've wanted that for my son. And now I'm bringing all that and immortality to him, to all of Arth.
Believe what suits you, said Tyrone. I want no part of it.
So that's where we stand. From within his flaming skull, Datar leveled an icy stare at the Knight Commander.
You must understand that this would be a very inconvenient time to modify the organizational chart with our upcoming march on Andoran. Plus, you play a pivotal role in our invasion. Most of my troops report to you, and delegating rather than subjugating is the key to my success.
I said I'll have no part in it, said Tyrone.
No, you said you wanted no part of it.
There's a difference, said the lich.
Fortunately, I don't have to use my energies to directly control the entire army. All I need do is control the one in charge, the one who has put himself at the center of my operations, and the rest of my subjects can still enjoy the benefits of their freedom.
Fear welled up in Tyrone, but he raised his chin and looked the lich in the eye sockets.
If dissent is insubordination, if I'm to be shackled for not taking part, are we really free?
The flames around Datar's head boiled and flared. I suppose not, he said, pulling the crown of iron thorns from within his robes. But as it turns out, I can make peace with that. Tyrion braced himself for the moment the crown touched the lich's skull, but it was futile. Some deep shred of the Night Commander's soul screamed, trying to fight the onslaught of the crown's power. The majority of him, however, felt any such notion washed away in a tide of dark magic. Inwardly writhing in silent torment, Tyrion marched out of the mausoleum, through the flaming remains of the town of East Upshore, and to the head of the ranks of skeletons, zombies, ghouls, and ghosts on the road to Andoran.
It's to be a siege, then, no later than the end of the month.
Bulby Baggs made the ominous pronouncement as he stared out the window. His back was to the rest of the ebony and marble office at the top of Goldson Baggs Group's headquarters on the 10th tier of Andoran. With one hand, he idly signed a document presented to him by some office acolyte or another. In the other, he held an ornate gold spyglass.
It's been a siege for days,
barked Fenrir Goldson, without looking up from the paperwork on his desk.
It's about to be a bloodbath.
Weaver Ortson stood between the titans of industry with a beleaguered scowl on his face.
You're talking about different things again,
he sighed with waning patience.
Not at all, Mr. Ortson. I was just commenting to Mr. Goldson that I can see the smoke from the undead incursion in the southeast.
Mr. Baggs shrugged.
Their arrival will send the stock tumbling. Which is what I was talking about,
said Mr. Goldson.
We've been propping our share price up with a few rapid acquisitions, but with the attack on Andoran, the threat indexes have gone mad. The investors will be out for blood.
So you see, we're on the same page,
said Baggs. Although you do worry too much, Mr. Goldson, we have plenty of liquidity.
Which is what brings me to your office, gentlemen,
said Ortson.
This had better not be about paying more for the city's defense, said Goldson. You'll recall that our firm already made a generous donation, added Baggs.
Oh, no. I mean, yes. I mean...
Ortson took a deep breath.
I'm not asking you to directly pay for the heroes, but the Heroes Guild would appreciate an upfront payment from your firm. An advance of sorts.
An advance on what?
Snorted Fenrir.
Well, on the death of the Lich and on the value your CTOs are sure to gain once he's finally dead. Again.
The value? You think... The CTOs...
Goldson was indignant and mystified in equal measure.
Do you even know how collateralized threat obligations work, sir?
Ortson felt a bead of sweat on his brow.
Do you?
Mr. Goldson and Mr. Baggs shared an awkward glance.
Well, generally, I'm not intimately familiar with the details, said Goldson.
The math is very complicated, added Mr. Baggs.
Still, it's apparent that we understand them better than you,
asserted Goldson.
Once a threat obligation has been triggered, it pays out. After that, it's worthless paper. They don't gain value again. And if our CTO was using such threat obligations for collateral, it's no better off. Besides, even if they gained value, we wouldn't owe the Heroes Guild a cent, said Baggs. We're not obligated to pay you a portion of our profits, just like you're not obligated to pay us for the massive losses your guild's ineptitude has cost us.
The ancient dwarf gave Ortson a withering glare.
Well, in a very real way, we have.
Ortson forced an uncomfortable smile.
You see, the Heroes Guild was the original issuer of threat obligations. We've been selling them for quite some time as a way to generate immediate revenue. The Guild has paid out huge sums for our threat obligations.
We're aware of the obligations you've paid, said Goldson coldly. And we're much more concerned with the ones you haven't, added Baggs.
The entire kingdom is depending on the guild to rally heroes to the defense of the city, and those heroes aren't rallying without funds, said Ortson. Surely you must see my problem.
Yes, but we also see that it is exactly that, said Goldson. Your problem,
Baggs added, noting Ortson's confusion.
It's going to be everybody's problem soon, said Ortson. If I can't get more heroes to the city, we're all doomed.
Ortson, you're so melodramatic when you're sober, sighed Bags. Help yourself to a drink. I don't want a drink, snarled Ortson. There's a first time for everything, smirked Goldson.
We're running out of time. It may already be too late.
Poor odds and bad timing don't sound like a good investment, Mr. Ortson, chided Bags, pouring himself a tumbler of whiskey.
Investment, said Ortson. You could die!
Or we could take the pair of great eagles on our roof down to the Knife Vale office.
Goldson opened a small black case on his desk to reveal a sprite stone.
Buy 40,000 of Andorran insurance at 5 Gilton, he commanded with a tap on the stone.
The small green sprite leapt into existence and flew for an open window.
But, gentlemen, please, Andorran is your home, protested Ortson.
Home is where the heart is, said Bags. Or at least where it stays beating, added Goldson mirthlessly. Buy 500,000 shares of Vorpal Corporation at 2 Gilton.
Ortson was flabbergasted.
And what of the people in the streets? What about your workers and colleagues? Where are your principles?
A hint of scowl creased Bag's face.
We are standing on our principles. Buy low, sell high, Goldson said,
just before he unleashed another green sprite with a muttered order.
Keep to the investment strategy, no matter what the markets do, said Bags. Watch fundamentals, not sentiment, Goldson barked. Those, Mr. Ortson, are key among our principles, said Mr. Bags, although we also hold it true and dear that private companies should not be pressed upon to fund public institutions beyond the exorbitant tax rates we already pay. We hope that Andorran can rally and defeat this threat. We'll make a killing if they do, Goldson muttered to himself as he made a note in his ledger.
Bags didn't skip a beat.
But if they cannot, if darkness triumphs, then our duty will still be to our investors, and the responsibility for the tragedy will fall upon the city-state and its institutions. It's time to hold government accountable, said Goldson.
And what of the business community's part in this mess?
Ortson demanded.
Need I remind you of the role your firm has played in this calamity?
There's already been much done to hold business responsible, said Bags. Surely you'll recall that Lamia sisters took a tumble last month. And they were thrown over the wall, too, added Goldson.
Were they really? Asked Bags.
Yes, and a number of other bankers with them. James Sapphire, that Mr. Stern fellow, half the board of J.P. Gorgon. Ghastly. I thought people were just talking about their share prices.
Bags shrugged.
But there, several bankers paid the ultimate price, and many more have been shut down.
Goldson perked up for a moment.
Which reminds me, we're to sign for buying out Silverguard securities from Mr. Poldo in a half hour.
And there it is, snapped Weaver. Others may be suffering, but you're still buying up companies. How have you two been brought to account for your role in this disaster?
Oh, we take full responsibility for our actions, said Mr. Bags.
We had to say as much in front of the royal court, added Goldson.
That's it, then, cried the guildmaster. Full responsibility and no consequences.
Now we're playing semantics, said Bags with a reptilian smile. And we're better at it than you, said Goldson.
Weaver was about to press the point further, but a tiny ball of pink light wafted in through the window, working against the line of Goldson's green sprites that dutifully streamed out the window. It fluttered over to hover a few inches from Ortson's face.
I have a message for Weaver Ortson,
chirped the sprite.
Yes, I can see that,
said Ortson, shielding his eyes from the intensely pink luminescence.
Pardon me, gentlemen. Play the message. Hello? Hello? Is this? How do I start this?
Said the sprite in its high, tweeting voice.
Just tap the stone, sire. Like this? Yes, sir. Oh, I thought I did that.
Weaver rolled his eyes. The sprite was filled with sudden bravado.
Ha! Weaver! The forces of evil are massing at our doorstep, and we shall meet them in glorious battle. I look forward to riding with your heroes into the heart of the darkness and ridding this land of the undead scourge once and for all. Ha ha! Come join us as soon as you can to finalize the plans for the defense of the city.
Weaver felt the blood drain out of his face at the sprite's laughter, like a blast from a minuscule trumpet. He'd have to face Johann with a woefully small cadre of heroes to offer, and there was no time left to recruit more. The sprite was still buzzing inanely in Ortson's face.
How do you stop it? Has it stopped? Tell it you are done, sire. What? I thought it would have made a sprite by now. Just tell it you are done, Majesty. Oh, I just say...
With a little sigh, the glowing ball winked out of existence.
It seems you are in high demand, Mr. Ortson, said Bags. Well, we do wish you luck with your plans. We have a lot invested in your success. Indirectly, added Goldson, please, don't let us keep you from your duty.
But gentlemen,
Ortson began in a quivering voice. Two of the most powerful men on Arth swiveled to face him, eyebrows raised, wielding expectant smiles as a phalanx raises shields. It was answer enough. There were no funds coming, and it was too late to spend them, even if they did. Ortson dabbed sweat away from his forehead.
I think I will have that drink before I depart.
And make this one on the rocks, please.
Dwinpoldo looked around the empty common room of the stranded sailor. The inn sat on the road between Andoran and Dunhelm, close enough to the capital that it still fell in Mount Windspar's shadow in the early morning. The road should have been bustling with carts and caravans, but Poldo hadn't seen a fellow traveler in days. The bartender returned and set a gold-colored cocktail in front of Poldo.
Well, I'm afraid that's the last of them, sir. I've run out of Grundent juice, and brandy for that matter. If you're still thirsty afterward, we have good dwarven whiskies left.
This will do, thank you.
Poldo was too fond of his internal organs to inflict dwarven whiskey on them. He turned back to the papers in front of him.
I should get back to work while I still can.
As it suits you, sir.
The barkeep turned his attention back to his own task, which involved an unusual amount of shoving things into a satchel. Poldo took a stamp from his briefcase and pressed it firmly down on the contract in front of him, leaving official document branded in scarlet letters across the top. He initialed the first page, and then the 14 others after that, and finally signed and dated the last sheet in the bundle. Then he slipped the documents into a brown paper envelope and handed it to a quartet of wood gnomes waiting patiently at the end of the bar.
I suppose it's time to take this to the headquarters of Goldson Bags, he said with a sigh.
The wood gnomes chittered a question.
Yes, well, Silverguard may not be worth much anymore, but it was mine, said Poldo.
He drummed his fingers on the old oak bar that was serving as a makeshift desk.
I plan to grow the business into the talk of Andoran, a firm successful enough to show Goldson and Bags what they'd lost in Dwinpoldo. And now they've made a light snack of it.
The wood gnome closest to Poldo chirruped sympathetically.
Ah, well, the gods weave what they will,
Poldo said.
Safe travels.
The words hadn't left his lips before the wood gnomes vanished, taking his document and his business with them. Then he drained his imperial pepper up on the rocks. Two small glasses were set on the bar in front of him. He looked up to see the bartender pouring two dwarven whiskies.
A toast, the barkeep explained, to losing our businesses.
You as well?
Asked Poldo.
I'm leaving it all behind and sailing for Knifevale. Even when the thrice-cursed lich is finally sent back to Mordo Og, the Freedlands won't be a place fit for running a business.
The barkeep glared out the window, sending a long-distance evil eye toward Mount Windspar.
The big banks are all dying off, and the merchants and carters can't get notes of credit to cover the goods they're shipping. Not that there's anyone to ship them to, mind you. The markets in Andoran have all but shut down. It'll take years to recover from this. More years than I've got in these old bones.
That assumes the undead will fail, said Poldo.
The innkeeper shrugged.
Oh, I'm sure the forces of light will find a way to rally and save the day. I've done as much against dragons, the Sten, Slaw, Orcs, Undead, the Red Horde, the Dark Ones, Gremlins. Seems to me if the forces of good weren't adept at that sort of dramatic last-minute victory over the forces of darkness, a place as volatile as Arth would have burned itself out long ago.
Who's to say it hasn't?
Poldo stared out the window at the distant mountain.
The Sten were considered paragons of the Light's forces until they were wiped out in the War of Betrayal, and Andoran was part of the Empire of Man in the Fifth Age. The Imperials must have thought their world was crumbling when the rebels seized it. How many times has the world ended before? Perhaps we are just toiling among its ashes.
A good point, but it stands to reason that if the forces of Manon or their ilk triumphed, none of us would be here, said the barkeep. Evil's never really won.
Perhaps, said Poldo grimly, but there's a first time for everything.
The innkeeper held up his glass in toast.
Well then, to the status quo, and getting by among the ashes, he said.
As best we can, said Poldo, holding up his own glass.
They drained their glasses in unison, and then endured synchronized facial spasms as the dwarven whiskey lived up to its reputation.
And on that note, I've a few matters to attend to, said Poldo.
A trio of wood gnomes carried a folio of papers to him. The first page was a letter from Mrs. Herc, letting him know that more tenants were arriving daily and requesting that he move some funds around. Vilma of the Firehawk tribe had attached the necessary documents.
You've got to keep fighting the good fight, eh?
The barkeep resumed packing up his bar.
Indeed,
Poldo muttered, dipping his quill in ink.
And there will always be more paperwork.
It always comes down to paperwork, muttered Lorona, though to be fair, it usually doesn't involve this much effort.
Not to mention this much sorcery.
Jin nodded at the structure erected by the orcish wise ones and a few goblin shamans. It was a timber archway built on the sea-smoothed foundations of some long-forgotten building and propped up by barnacle-encrusted rocks. Runes were carved into the bark of the trees and filled in with red paint, apparently for emphasis, but they could do little to attract attention in light, literally, of the huge luminous crystal set at the top of the arch. It rested in a cradle of hewn logs, where gremlins and goblins in shaman's garb fawned over it incessantly.
"Extraordinary times call for extraordinary measures," said Gorm. "That thermal crystal is the key to getting back to Andoran in time."
"Thaumite crystal," Jin corrected him.
"Whatever you call it," said Gorm.
A voice spoke up from behind the four heroes.
"My people call it Warbo's Zaburbferost, the Path of the Stars."
"Chieftain,"
said Gorm, leading the other heroes in a bow as a Shurzu strode up to them, accompanied by a retinue of wise ones. The chieftain wore a fresh set of gold and violet silks, and any sign of her wounds had been washed away by her shaman's healing magic. Darak loomed behind her, studying his knuckles in the idle manner of someone prepared to put them to good use. Ashurzu acknowledged them with a nod, and then pointed at the great hunk of thaumite atop the ramshackle arch.
"The crystal came from the gremlins of the Shadespear. They gave it to the Gizvarda when Char saved them from a lightling band soon after father's death. And before Char gave it a new name, the gremlins called it Fulgen's Rest."
"So they followed Fulgen as well?" asked Laruna. The chieftain watched the gremlins and shamans work over the great crystal.
"I think they mostly thought it a good joke. Father Tinderhope is the light at the end of the tunnel, and these waygates, as you call them, are the tunnels at the end of the light. But I suppose they wouldn't have known to make the joke if there weren't so many followers of the underglow among our peoples."
"Including yourself," said Gorm.
Ashurzu gave a small private smile.
"My father always said that silent gods are the easiest kind to follow. Beyond that, Fulgen teaches us to strive onward and take hope when all seems lost. It is a message my people need."
"We all need it sometimes," said Gorm.
"You speak truth."
The chieftain turned her attention back to the archway.
"Let us begin."
The waygate attendants nodded and began weaving threads of magic over the runes. The glyphs flared with light, and a moment later a shimmering portal winked into existence beneath the arch. Through the waygate, Gorm could see a cadre of dwarves clad in the blue and white heraldry of the Old Kingdom. A familiar figure led them.
"This way, this way!"
Heraldon ushered several dwarves lugging heavy-looking chests through the shimmering gateway.
"Mind your step, loose gravel ahead.
I see you managed to convince King Forder to send a delegation through a magic portal,"
Gorm said, ambling up to the bard.
"Was there ever any doubt?" asked Heraldon. "I can talk my way through just about any situation."
"Aye, but they say half of diplomacy is listening," said Gorm, "and you're rubbish at that."
"Right, that would be Geistsaf."
The bard nodded to the weapons master, who was carrying a large crate through the waygate. Geist rolled his eyes. Within an hour, a long line of Shadowkin shuffled toward rows of dwarven clerks sitting at desks made from repurposed chests and crates. A sibilant whispering filled the air as a multitude of pens scribbled furiously on reams of forms. A swarm of dwarves worked behind the line, fetching paper and ink, reviewing and stamping applications, and trying to fight the growing pile of paperwork to be filed away. It was a losing battle. Gorm walked along the line with Ashurzu and several of the leaders of the old dwarven kingdom, surveying the progress.
"How long do you think this'll take us?" he asked.
Guildmaster Corgan pursed his lips.
"If we work hard and Kazan is with us, we might be mobilized in 5 days."
5 days!
Exclaimed Gorm.
"The lich is bearing down on Enderin. We don't have a week for thrice-cursed paperwork. How do we get this going faster?"
"Faster?"
Corgan waved toward the crowd of Shadowkin.
"Do you know how many steps we're skipping to get these Shadowkins sworn in as citizens and conscripted into the guild? The clerks are going to be sorting this out for weeks, maybe months. You can't just hand them a bit of paper and call them a hero. Or a dwarf, for that matter." "Congratulations, you're a dwarven hero."
A nearby clerk handed a small red booklet and a bundle of loose pages to an orc across the table.
"Dagob Zedfrost!"
The orc held his new papers over his head as he shouted back to the lines of Shadowkin behind him. Several cheers and whoops rang out in reply.
"Yes, well, it takes a lot of steps to get there,"
said Corgan airily.
"Of course, honored guildmaster, but I wonder if there is not a way to save time,"
suggested Ashurzu.
"Many tribe mates share the same homeland, for example." "Much of the same family history, too,"
Corgan stroked his beard absently as he watched the clerks work.
"And they share a dialect, of course."
"Dialect?"
asked Gorm.
"Language,"
Corgan snapped, waving the question away.
"The form assumes it's a dialect of the dwarven tongue, naturally, but it works well enough."
"It is so,"
said Ashurzu.
"With so much common information, is there not a way to fill out the pages faster?"
The dwarf scratched at his beard.
"Aye, since it's going to be the same for so many, perhaps we could make a cover sheet for a docket of applications. And that would mean they don't need to fill out Guild Form 1974. Then let it be said that we have found many opportunities for efficiency,"
Ashurzu said.
"Looks as much,"
Corgan acknowledged grudgingly.
"I'll see what I can do."
Gorm watched the guildmaster trudge off to confer with his clerks.
"I thought it'd take a team of minotaurs to get Corgan to take a step he didn't think of. And ye've got him toddling off like a forge lad fetching water."
"People move mountains, but words move people,"
said Ashurzu.
"Such is the way of persuasive selling. My father showed me its power, and now I shall sell the world a vision."
"It's a nice thought, chieftain, and I wish you luck with it."
Gorm watched Corgan and his clerks working furiously to alter a running process. It put him in mind of trying to build a dam while the river was flooded.
"But the dream won't be worth much if we can't get these fighters to Andoran fast enough."
"Or if we don't have enough of them," said Caitha, walking up behind them.
"That too?"
Gorm looked over on the neat rows of troops, softly chatting with one another as they waited in queue. Many Shadowkin had declared that they would never follow Ashurzu, and several tribes and factions splintered away from the Red Horde. Or perhaps they left to be the new Red Horde. It was hard to follow the politics, but any way you looked at it, the old dwarven kingdoms lost a third of their new army before a blade was drawn against the undead.
"How goes the strategy session?"
he asked. Caitha shrugged.
"It looks to be a long, hard fight. Nobody knows which way it will go."
"Aye, but the point of having a strategy is to improve your odds," said Gorm.
"I was talking about the strategy session."
Gorm squeezed his eyes shut and let out a heavy breath as he rubbed his eyebrows.
"Trouble cooperating?"
The elf nodded.
"There's more than a little tension between High Commander Harrick and the Shadowkin generals. Orcs and dwarves were often in fights together, but never on the same side."
"Well, there's a first time for everything, ain't there?"
Gorm bowed to Ashurzu.
"Pardon, chieftain, but I've got to go settle a matter if we're to ride out any time soon."
Ashurzu smiled and inclined her head.
"May your words be persuasive and your dealings be successful, Gorm Ingerson."
Gorm answered through his teeth before he stamped down the muddy path.
"I'll leave that to better speakers and better times. If you want to get anything done, there comes a point when you have to crack a few skulls."